There were two little boys, ages 7 and 9, in a small town in Illinois. And they were known for being the bad kids in town. Anything happened, a window's broken, it's these kids. Something stolen, the watermelon from the patch, these kids are involved. Their parents were just pulling their hair out, wondering what to do with these rambunctious young boys. And a minister moved into town, pastor of a small church there, and they heard word that he was pretty effective in putting the fear of God into these types of children. So they called him and asked, could we have our kids, could you come and visit with our kids and just help them out so they're not so rambunctious and so they're not so mischievous? He said, sure, I'd be glad to. So they invited him over one day. And his strategy was to take the kids and divide and to conquer. So he took the 7-year-old and took them into the den in this family's house. And he sat this 7-year-old boy down and he says, where is God? The little boy just big saucer eyes and just sat there. And the minister raised his voice and he says, where is God? Eyes got bigger, he stiffened up. And a minister, he put his finger in his face and he said, where is God? And a little boy, just scared to death, jumped up, ran out, ran into his bedroom, locked himself in the closet, slammed the door. And the 9-year-old saw what had happened. So, 9-year-old, he goes in the bedroom and opens the door, jumps in there with him. He says, what happened? He said, oh man, we are in big trouble this time. God's missing and they think we did it. Well, actually, God is missing in the lives of a lot of people. People don't know God. They don't know who He is. They have doubts about what He did and what role He has to play in their lives. Psalm chapter 14 and verse 1. Psalm chapter 14 and verse 1, it speaks of people who doubt God to some degree or the other. Right now there's a big hubbub about the Da Vinci Code and, well, Christ, who is God, actually was just a human being. That's their conclusion, and he was just a nice guy, but he certainly wasn't God. And God is missing in their lives for those who would believe such rubbish. But Psalm chapter 14 and verse 1 says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They're corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that does good. You get people with abominable works in a lot of ways, from the atheist to the evolutionist, to the individual who believes that Christ was just a very nice human being, but certainly not God in the flesh. And it says they're corrupt. Verse 2, the Lord looks down from heaven on the children of men to see if there are any who understand and to seek God. Not just to know that He exists, because statistically you take polls and most people believe that God exists. To one degree or one form of the other, and involve themselves to one degree or the other with God and who He is. And God is looking to see who really seeks me and who understands. Romans chapter 1, one of my favorite scriptures in the Bible, actually. In Romans 1, it says so much, and it answers a lot of questions about who is God. What is He doing here? What is His role in my life? Romans chapter 1 and verse 19. It says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They don't want people to know the truth, or they refuse themselves to believe the truth. They see something of God. God reveals Himself to them, but they suppress it. They keep it hidden. and they will refuse to allow God to play a role in their lives, and to believe even that He exists or that He had a hand in the creation of all things. But God says, I don't buy it. He says, I won't even accept that type of ignorance. He says, because verse 19, because that what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Where is God? God shows us where He is. He shows us that He exists. He shows us that He is the Creator of all things by the creation. God's shown it to them. Verse 20, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen. Who has seen God? Nobody's seen God the Father. But He reveals Himself. And actually, you can know that He exists by looking around you, by seeing the things that He has created. And He says He leaves no excuse. He says, being understood. So how do we understand God? How do we know who and what God is? Being understood by the things that are made, by the things He created. He said, all you need to do really is just look around you. And He says, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Verse 21, because that although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God. And people look around and they say, wow, things are incredible. I mean, the creation is so amazing. And how things are here and what they're made of and composed of and the order and the design is just so amazing. But God certainly couldn't have had a part in it because I don't believe that He did. And so if I don't believe it, then it must be so. The people put themselves up and puff themselves up as some great thing or some great person with some great understanding and deny God's existence. But He says, really, He says, because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became as fools. And people profess themselves to be wise, people with degrees after their name that are very, very impressive. For example, Dr. Richard Lewontin, he's a Harvard geneticist. I mean, Harvard, a geneticist. The guy's got to be sharp. I know he's a lot smarter than I am as far as brain power. He said in a book that he entitled Billions and Billions of Demons, he said, materialism is absolute. For we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. In other words, things were created, not created, things evolved, things just developed, and things are made of material, there's no spirit involved. We can't allow even the thought that God might have had something to do with it. How foolish is that to deny God's power? To deny God's ability to create and to make everything in this universe. It is foolishness, isn't it? Professor Francis Crick said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. And you got to constantly keep that in mind because as a biologist, you would look and you would see the wonders of creation. You would see the design. You would see how marvelously it was put together. But, you know, and you might start thinking, well, certainly this couldn't have just happened. Certainly there has to be a God. No. You can't allow any possibility that there could be a God. So don't think about creation. In other words, I don't care what the evidence says. We cannot give God credit. The question of does God exist is a question actually of prime importance in our lives. Now, I know that you're here because you believe God exists. And the world sees it, believes it to some degree. But really, why is it that important if God exists? One thing, because if God doesn't exist, if God didn't create us, then we're pretty much free to do what we want to do. But if God does exist, then He created us, and He can tell us what to do. It's like if you created, it's, you know, like Henry's motorcycle, you know, he put a lot of time into creating it and creating this marvelous wonder that he runs and operates. And if I were to go to that motorcycle and sit on it and say, hey, I'm going to do with this what I want, I don't think that would go over very well. He's got plenty of experience in his history to take me out easily. But he's the creator of it, and he can do with it what he wants. And I can't do with it what I want. Now, God exists. He created us. And as the creator, he can do with us what he wants. He's the one that tells us what to do, how to do it, and we must respond. If there is no creator, we can do what we want. Charles Darwin, in his autobiography, said this. He said, a man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God. So the person that doesn't believe, if there's a personal God that deals with people, that is concerned, that cares, that wants us to succeed and so forth, he has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or a fixed existence with retribution and rewards. In other words, if they're not a God that punishes for disobedience, that rewards for obedience, he said he can have for his rule of life, as far as I see it, only to follow his impulses and instincts. So if there's no God with rules, within punishments and rewards, then you're free to do what you want. But if there is a God with rules and then punishments and rewards, you're not free to do what you want. You are not your own. You are God's. So it does make a difference. If you take Genesis chapter 1 and then the other areas in the Bible that speak of the creation out of the Bible and take creation out of the whole thing, then Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and things concerning Christ and other things don't have much meaning. But God is the creator. God does have a plan. He did put everything together with that plan in mind. God's creation, when it, you know, when you read that, man really can't deny the power of God because of how wonderfully everything was made and created. Dr. Richard Dawkins, he's a strong evolutionist from England. Very pro-evolution. And he made this statement that would appear to go against evolution before creation, but he's putting it, he's saying something that's a little strained. He said, we have seen that the living things are too improbable and too beautifully designed to have come into existence by chance. When he says you look around at it and things are so beautifully designed, it's so marvelously made that it couldn't have come by chance, and he's not actually saying that it didn't come by chance, he's just saying that chance took an incredible leap. I mean, this chance is just amazing what chance did. But we know that God didn't create anything, or God doesn't have an involvement, because we can't allow that because we're man. And we tell God what to do. He doesn't tell us what to do. Chance. What are the odds of evolution actually occurring? In that video series we saw, they started off on discussing the Sabbath and showing that, chance has no chance. But it's interesting to think about. A couple of weeks ago, we had a sermonette on a desire to win the lottery. I think that was the motive, is to get you to pray so that Peter would win the lottery. I think that was the purpose of the sermon when I got out of that. But I made an allusion to this in my comments in my sermon afterwards, but there was an analysis by a Louisville Courier Journal, and they were analyzing the chances of winning the lottery. And this guy gave us a few statistics. He said the odds of being struck by lightning, and that figure varies when you Google it and you try to find where the odds of being struck by lightning, but it's approximately 1 in 700,000. And have you been struck by lightning? Any of you know somebody that has? Do you? What happened? Yeah. He got hit by lightning twice. Those are pretty big odds that that would happen. There's actually a story, and I can't remember which camp that it took place at. This is if you want to increase your odds, at camp a few years ago, this big bolt of lightning struck close to the campers. And this teenage kid at camp says, "God, is that the best you can do?" The next bolt actually hit him. And it didn't kill him. But I really don't think he's going to say that again. But one in 700,000. Now, that's not, you know, if we took did a little raffle here and everybody had a raffle ticket and one person got a prize, I wouldn't be the one to get it. I know that already, because I don't have good odds even with, you know, about 40 people. But one in 700,000. Now, the odds of winning the Kentucky lottery are about one in 5.25 million. Okay, 1 in 5.25 million. So you want to, I think maybe I'll try the lottery. 1 in 5.25 million. Now, a mathematics professor in Ireland, Des McHale, did the chances of winning the Irish lottery. So when you guys were over there, and I don't know if you didn't get to Ireland, and you didn't play the lottery. Okay. Okay. Okay, because you don't appear to be a stupid person. The chances of winning the Irish lottery are approximately 10 million to 1. Now, if you're taking notes, you might just do this for your little exercise here. I'll write 10 with 6 zeros behind it. Okay, just to humor me, for 10 with 6 zeros behind it if you're taking notes. Now, how would you like to have those odds? It's approximately the same odds as being kicked to death by a donkey. Anybody ever been kicked to death by a donkey? Well, you wouldn't admit to it, I suppose, if you had. This Des McHale, he says you've got the same chances of winning the Irish lottery as if you didn't buy a ticket at all. Okay, so it kind of puts it in. Now, when we start talking about evolution, okay, then we start talking about odds. Okay, now, these guys say that the odds that the four proteins that make up the building block of the genetic code, say, Neil, you probably understand this stuff, don't you? No? Okay. Neil doesn't. Nobody does. But, or Helmut? A lot of you really smart guys out here, and ladies, you should, but anyway, the odds that the four proteins that make up the basic building block of the genetic code would happen randomly to form the cornerstone for life are approximately, give or take, 10 to the 25th power. Okay, now if you want to dazzle yourself with this, just write 10 and then put 25 zeros after it. Okay. Now, chances. Now, you got a friend that was hit by lightning and twice, and those are pretty good chances. We're talking about some of this last time I was here, and what's his name? The guy from Mexico over here. You guys are all from New Mexico, aren't you? I'm not giving you a clue. Anyway, his wife was doing bingo and won this incredible odds, you know, that doesn't happen. So, you know, some of these odds happen. But 10 to the 25th power, 10 with 25 zeros after it. And now, another chemist, A.J. White, University of Wales, said that if you had the right environment, okay, first you have to have the right environment, okay, and the odds of the right environment just happening, they didn't give those odds, and the right mixture of chemicals. And so if somehow you involve a right environment, right, like we have to have a right environment, right? I mean, if we don't have the air conditioner going, we're too hot and we fall asleep during church. You know, right environment is very important. So you get the right environment and the right chemicals that would have to show up out of nothing. Okay, then the odds of producing one small protein. Now, remember I said that the four proteins that make up the building block to the formation of life would be 10 with 25 zeros after it. But the odds of one protein under right circumstances being produced would be one chance in 10, or one chance in 10 followed by 67 zeros. Okay, so now I'm not going to be asking you to write 67 zeros by now, but you could, you know, if you want to keep writing zeros. And these are chances. Remember, chance of being struck by lightning was 1 in 700,000. Okay, now we're talking, I don't even know how you would say that. And those of you who are mathematicians, how do you say 10 with 67 zeros after it? Any takers on that? Like a bazillion or something like it. Yeah. So is there a name for it? You know, like there's a million and a billion and a trillion and a quadrillion and a supernova billion or whatever it is. Okay, so let's kind of try to wrap in your, you know, if you were going to win something, you probably wouldn't buy the ticket at those odds. Okay, now the odds of this, now there's the theory of evolutionists is there was some primordial soup of that right mixture of chemicals that kind of formed and created this right environment for things to be able to maybe start to develop to begin the possibility of life thinking about evolving. Okay, now actually when you study more of it, they say that scientists say, well, actually we figure that primordial soup couldn't have even happened here. So the primordial soup had to have been like happened somewhere else and imported here, like by aliens or something. And we don't know where the aliens came from or how that primordial soup just happened to get from that point to this, which adds a few more percentage, you know, zeros to your equation here. But the odds, though, of that primordial soup starting here on Earth is 10 to the 40,000th power. Okay, so if you want to write 10 and then write 40,000 zeros behind it. So, Kyle, you want to start? I want you to be, by the time services are done today, I want you to 10 with 40,000 zeros. You got that? What are the odds? You know, not very great. I suppose, given enough time, 10 with 40,000 zeros, a chance. The idea of life starting spontaneously by chance would be like this. Okay, Peter, pay attention. It would be like if you bought a lottery ticket every day, that the chances of life happening on Earth would be the same as if you would win $1 million grand prize in the lottery every day for the next 10,000 years. Those chances. Okay. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands on how many of you like won the $25 lottery or anything like that, but $1 million lottery every day of your life for 20 or the next 10,000 years. Carl Sagan, Mr. Billions and Billions, Carl Sagan, he figured that the odds of man evolving. Kyle, you done with your zeros yet on the 40,000? Because we're going to do this. Chances of man evolving, and he believes that man did evolve, are one chance in 10 to the 2 billionth power. Okay, so you got to get started on writing 10 with 2 billion zeros after it. That's the chance of man having evolved. Now, there are some smart guys. Dr. Harry Rimmer was apparently only one of 12 men in the world around 1940 to understand Einstein's theory of relativity. And his comment was, I fail to see how the natural man can scoff at the faith of a Christian who believes in one miracle of creation when the unbeliever accepts multitude of miracles to justify his violation of every law of biology and every evidence of paleontology to cling to his exploded myth of evolution. He says things evolving, he says, it just can't happen. How can God happen? I can't give you that answer either. I just know that he does exist. And you either believe that all of these laws just developed on their own, or that God created those, but you're believing that on faith either way. Now, God made things for us. How do we know that God exists? Well, let's look up and learn. Let's look around and learn. I wish we were outside today. I wish we were at the camp out today, because we could learn a little more than we will inside of the confines of this building, but we'll give it a shot anyway. Turn to Psalm chapter 19. Psalm chapter 19. If you want to know if God exists. Now again, I believe you're here because you know God exists. But Romans chapter 1, it says he tells us. You're without excuse. Nobody can say, you know, God doesn't exist, really, when you look around and let God tell you that he exists and that he is. Psalm chapter 19, verse 1, New Century Version says, the heavens tell the glory of God, and the skies announce what his hands have made. You know, you go into Kmart and it says, attention, Kmart shoppers. You know, look at the blue light over here. You know, the heavens announce God. It says, he says, here I am. Remember that one video clip that I showed a while back at feast time when it starts off on earth and then it kind of goes out and extends and goes through the planets and then, you know, in so many billion light years and this is what it's, you know, I can't even wrap my mind around it to any degree. When you see the vast expanse of heaven and what it does, and just look at the planets and the stars and the sun and its relationship to the earth and all of the all the things that it does. It says, verse 2, day after day, they tell the story. Night after night, they tell it again. You want to know if God exists? Look around you. Let what you see around you, let creation tell you the story. That's why Paul said that men are without excuse, because the things that are not seen, God whom we haven't seen, he shows us the things that he has made as evidence. Verse 3, they have no speech or words. They have no voice to be heard. And no, hopefully you're not really hearing the voices. If you are hearing the voices, we can talk, okay? But it's not saying that you're actually going to hear voices, but you're going to hear God's announcement about who he is. And he says, verse 4, but their message goes out through all the world. Their words go everywhere on earth. Anywhere you look, you're going to see the power of God and what he has done. You know, the Big Bang Theory, evolutionists say that at the Big Bang of the universe, there was this explosion that shot out in all directions. And, you know, when you take a look up into the heavens and you see the planets and the stars and all of the incredible creation, just go on to any website like the Hubble website or NASA or whatever and just look at all those things. And all that stuff you see, just one day, there was a massive explosion that occurred. And Robert Jastrow, he's a professor of physics and astronomy, and he's got to be smart, so he's got to know what he's talking about, obviously. He says the universe exploded out of nothing. What a great trick. Nothing means no space, no atoms, no molecules, no neurons or protons or neutrinos or anything else that man is finding that things are consisting of, but nothing was there. You know, and you could try to explain that. It's like, okay, let's just take this that I've got in my hands right now. But even that's not nothing, because there's little air stuff circulating around molecules and little things that cause your nose to run and all this stuff in the air that actually wasn't there. Okay, so not even that was there, but it was everywhere. So this was just all there was, but nothing. Okay, now one day, this great explosion occurred. And everything you see out there is now there. Wow, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? Now, how did that occur? Well, what, are you stupid or something? Of course you know. Alan Guth, MIT senior scientist, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, senior scientist. So he's smart, and so he can explain how all this, that has nothing, suddenly blew into a big bang. He explains it this way. He says, in this view, the universe would originate as a quantum fluxation starting from absolutely nothing. A quantum fluxation. Anybody explain that to me? Come on, some of you guys work up at the lab and everything. Quantum fluxation? No? Neil? Give it a shot? I thought you guys were smart. You just blew my impression of you altogether. A quantum fluxation started this all. Now, I'd love to have one of those for my car. Basically, a quantum fluxation is an amount of energy that moves quickly. Okay? So you've got absolutely nothing. And how did everything get there? Well, there was this quantum fluxation, this massive amount of energy that moved really quickly, and that kind of sparked this thing that made everything. And so, you know, all like this, and, you know, we were outside, you could pick up a rock and see, and look up in the heavens and see the stars and at night and the sun and day. And that's where it all came from this massive amount of energy. But, you know, men are trying to reproduce or produce little bits of energy. You know, so they have windmills and they've got dams that produce electricity and they've got gas that they make to spark and ignite an internal combustion engine and all kinds of things to make energy. So energy is an incredible thing. I mean, where does energy come from and what is it? Well, I mean, energy is even more impressive than a rock, I think. You know, but then again, I'm not a physicist or anything like that. But, you know, a rock is relatively impressive, but energy? The energy created the rock. Well, actually, the energy did. The power of God did create all things. So, you know, from that perspective, he's got something there. He just doesn't know how much he's got. Okay? So, you think about it. The energy from nowhere produced everything that then produced an incredibly complex system of planets, a well-balanced universe, a well-balanced Earth, and the sun just happened to fall the right distance from the Earth. And all of these things just happened to be. So when you look up into the heavens and you think of evolution, you can't help but look up and say, huh? I don't know. God made things. And what you really do is you look up and you look at the universe, you look at the things around you, and you say, wow, the power of God is awesome. And if God has that power and he cares for me, what is he going to do for me, an actual human being, not just a rock? Job chapter 36. Job 36. Job was struggling with some personal issues, going through a lot of problems, a lot of difficulties, and wondering why God allowed that to land on him like he did. And Elihu is talking with him, and he's trying to get him to consider, you know, what life is about, and that God is in control. You know, God made everything, and God created you, Job, And he's able to do whatever he wants. And he's the power of the universe. He's the power of your life and of my life. And he said, I just want you to think a little bit. Okay, use your head. Job 36, verse 26, this is the New Living Translation. It makes it pretty easy to figure out what he's talking about. He says, look, God is exalted beyond what we can understand. Now you look up and you try to really understand God and how he got there and how God and the Word existed eternally forever, and I can't explain that either. But it's certainly a whole lot easier to understand than things just happening, because we see other evidences and existence of God's existence in our lives other than just the physical things, his involvement in our lives and the things that he does and the help that he gives, and there are many, many ways to explain God. He says, verse 30, he says, see how he spreads the lightning around him and how he lights up the depths of the sea. Verse 31, by his mighty acts he governs the people, giving them food in abundance. You look at the way that he sends rain to the earth and the way that he has water provide and provides life. He said he provides all of these things for people. And he's got a plan and a purpose, and his purpose for all of creation was to bring people into his family. So God's concerned with people. Verse 32, he fills his hands with lightning bolts and hurls each at its target. Don't you just love lightning? I mean, okay, so it's frightening, right? Okay. But, I mean, you think of lightning, and I just think it's a marvel. And you take lightning, and he said, I want you to think of lightning this way. God hurling lightning at its target. And God's not literally there taking each bolt of lightning and hurling it down, but he's saying, I just want you to understand that how is lightning produced? And you can study and you can have some idea, and particularly if you're a mathematician and so forth, you can have some idea of how lightning happens with the different positive and negative energies and all that type of thing. But think of it as God hurling lightning bolts. Next time you see this big thunderstorm, think of it in that way. Announces his creation to us. It says, verse 33, the thunder announces his presence. The storm announces his indignant anger. It was like you look up at the stars and the heavens and they announce God's power. Well, so do other things. And Elihu here is just focusing on basically one part of creation. One little aspect of creation. It's a pretty big aspect in many senses, but he says, just think about rain, water, lightning, things going around us in the atmosphere, and we can consider billions of other things. But let's consider this. Chapter 37 and verse 1. My heart pounds as I think of this. It leaps within me. You know, when you really start thinking about any aspect of God's creation, you say, man, this is awesome. This is absolutely incredible. You know, your heart's like pounding within you, and this is exciting. This is so amazing that this is going on. And he says, listen carefully to the thunder of God's voice as it rolls from his mouth. You'll think of lightning and thunder when you hear it as the voice of God. You know, the children of Israel, when they wanted God to speak to them, and God spoke to them on the mountain, and his voice rolled as thunder off of the mountain, they said, we don't want God to talk to us anymore. That's too frightening. And thunder and lightning is frightening if you're too close to it, particularly. But think of it as the mouth of God. It rolls across the heavens, and his lightning flashes in every direction. Then comes the roaring thunder, the tremendous voice of his majesty. He does not restrain the thunder when he speaks. God's voice is in the glorious thunder. We can't comprehend the greatness of his power. You know, and it's not literally the voice of God, but he created it. You know, when we go back to Henry, when Henry's rolling down the road, and he got the voice of thunder coming out of that exhaust. You know, Henry created that in a sense, and it's his voice coming out of the exhaust, you know. It's not literally his voice, but he created it, he made it, and making the noise. God made the lightning. It's His voice. Think of it as that way. Verse 6, as He directs the snow to fall on earth and tells the rain to pour down. If you think about snow, what's that? Well, it's water. It's vapor. It's just a different form. I mean, you take your glass of water and you think, okay, this is... And then, in the right circumstances, it comes down into snow where every little snowflake is different from every other snowflake that's ever fallen. And you think, that's pretty impressive. That's very amazing. And then it falls in the hills, and then it melts at the right time, and it brings water down here to feed people. Amazing. He says, and He tells the rain to pour down. And verse 7 says, everyone stops working at such a time so they can recognize His power. I bet you every one of you in this room at one time stopped working or stopped playing or doing whatever you're doing because this tremendous thunderstorm rolls through town. And the water is just pouring down and drenching everything. And you just stop and you look out the window or you walk outside under the cabana and you just watch it because it's so amazing. Or the snow that falls down. I've been in snow with 12-foot drifts. You know, and you stand up and you watch the snow and it's coming down in these sheets and you barely see and it's piling up. It's just a wonder. That's God doing all these things. He's responsible for that. It just happened from this explosion because a quantum flux hit it sometime. It says verse 8, the wild animals hide in their rocks or dens. A stormy wind comes from its chamber, driving the winds, bringing the cold. He said, even just watch the wind and watch the clouds and how they circulate around and you know what clouds are doing. One of the most amazing things to look at is flying. And you look out at this cloud layer that you're above, you know, and the rolling clouds, and especially at sunset, and you see the beauty and the colors, and you say, oh God, these light, fluffy clouds. Well, below those light, fluffy clouds comes this tremendous downpour of rain. You know, what's that all about? How does He make these fluffy clouds, and then it forms these droplets, and droplets turn big and fall down, either turn to snow or rain or hail? Amazing. It says the driving winds bring the cold. You know, you get that cold wind blowing through, and that's God. Verse 10, God's breath sends the ice, freezing wide expanses of water. Let's talk about some more about water, Elihu says. Let's just focus on this one aspect of God. What's ice? Well, ice is the same thing as snow is, and the same thing as water is, and the same thing that moisture in the clouds is, and it's all the same stuff, but just a different formation that God made, and now all this stuff, all of a sudden, it's hard. It's cold. Well, what's that about? It's amazing. Just look at any aspect of God, any aspect of creation, and you see God's power. And then freezing vast expanses of water. Anybody ever been up to Alaska and seen some of the ice flows or anything? That's kind of impressive, isn't it? You know, that's ice. That's what God has done. That's one aspect of His creation. Verse 11, He loads the clouds with moisture. They flash with His lightning. The clouds turn around and around under His direction. They do whatever He commands throughout the earth. Well, God doesn't, I don't believe that God is there having, He doesn't have to redirect each cloud pattern and every storm and everything else. He made the laws that make it happen. And on different occasions, He sticks His finger down in that law. And He makes things happen the way He wants it to specifically. And He does that. And He sends storms to destroy the Spanish Armada or whatever else that He's doing to cause history to happen the way it's going to happen. But He says, they do whatever He commands in the earth, and He causes things to happen on earth, either as a punishment or a sign of His unfailing love. Now, I know that Neil can relate to this. Okay. Mr. Kinsey's in agriculture. He got a degree from what? Southern Illinois University in marketing. Okay, so he sells all this stuff. that these people grow. But anyway, my wife's family knows about this. They are farmers, and you guys know about it. The rain comes at the right time, and it blesses you. The rains come at the wrong time, it wipes out your fields, it rots your hay. Rain can be a blessing or a curse. And God sometimes does it a punishment or a sign of His unfailing love. The people in New Orleans, I think they were probably considering that more on the punishment side of things. And I don't know how much God had His hand specifically in there, but I know that He can. And that He has. Verse 14. Listen, Job, stop and consider the wonderful miracles of God. Do you know how God controls a storm and causes lightning to flash from His clouds? Do you understand how He balances the clouds with its wonderful perfection and skill? Verse 17, with sweltering, you're sweltering in your clothes and the south wind dies down and everything is still. We know that God made Phoenix. He makes the skies reflect the heat like a giant mirror. So next time you're out there sweating and your arms are perspiring and you think, okay, God made heat too. And He gave us the ability to make air conditioners. We thank God for that too. Can you do that? Verse 19, you think you know so much? Teach the rest of us what God has to say. We're too ignorant to make our own arguments. Verse 20, should God be told that I want to speak? Can we speak when we're confused? And these people say, oh, we can't allow God, you know, a foot in the door of creation. You know, these guys are fools. Verse 21, we can't look at the sun because it shines brightly in the sky. When the wind clears away the clouds, the golden splendor comes from the mountain of God. He's clothed in dazzling splendor. When you look at the mountains and even looking up at your local mountains and you see the sunset and the snow reflecting off from it, it's like God's clothing, if you will. You know, it's think of God in every aspect of your life and creation. Verse 23, we can't imagine the power of the Almighty. Yet He's so just and merciful that He doesn't oppress us. Now, with all the things that He's made, all the things He's created, He cares for us. He involves Himself in our lives. You know, we're told, Christ said, to consider the birds of the field, that God cares for them, He feeds them. And if He cares for them, how much more does He care for us? God involves Himself, the great Creator of all things, involves Himself in our lives every day. Yet we find scientists, we find creators of textbooks saying that God does not exist. I'll just do one more quote here from a Los Angeles Unified School District textbook, ninth grade, called The Wonders of Science. It said, evolutionists account for life by chance that inanimate or non-living organic matter could somehow form life. Now, so far, overall, we've been talking about rocks, and we've been talking about water, and we've been talking about, you know, a lot of other things having to do with the universe and you know, physical things. But what about life? Well, you know, not only do we have the quantum flux making, you know, things not even designed like this podium, but hard, inanimate things. But these inanimate things then created life, the book says. And it goes on to say, evolutionists account for life by chance that inanimate or non-living inorganic matter could somehow form life. That the oceans and atmosphere on primitive Earth were accidentally composed of all the essential life chemicals. Quite an accident. And all the life chemicals are there and everything's set up. And that maybe lightning or something like that, quantum flux possibly, that stimulated the chemicals to bond together over billions of years and here we are today. This is their textbook. Here we are today. Job chapter 12. Now God says, all right, look at the heavens and let them announce my presence. Let them tell you that I'm here. Look at the thunder and the lightning and the snow and the ice and the rain and all those, the clouds, and know that I'm here. Let's go further than that. Job chapter 12 and verse 7. You want to know if God exists? Job 12, verse 7, New Century Version says, but ask the animals, and they'll teach you. Oh, shades of Dr. Doolittle here. Okay, talk to the animals, right? You can ask the animals if you want to know if I exist. Ask the birds of the air, and they'll tell you. Now again, don't go talking to the birds of the air, okay? I don't want to have that reported that you're actually talking to the animals like that. Well, some of you probably do. You go to your little bird and say, speak to me, come on. But verse 8, speak to the earth and it will teach you, or let the fish of the sea tell you. Verse 9, every one of these knows that the hand of the Lord has done this. You examine any part of life, from the smallest little protozoa to the largest beast that exists, or fish in the sea. And you start examining it. You remember, those of you who have been around since the 70s and so forth, remember a lot of the articles we used to print about the platypus, and you take a look at these various animals, and this couldn't have just happened. This had to be created. He said, and they tell you that God exists, because chances of it happening are not there. Verse 10, the life of every creature and the breath of all people are in God's hand. Your life is in God's hands. He created you, He made you, and He can tell you what to do. And we better listen. Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 6, Solomon was one who really looked a lot at what God had created. He looked at human nature, he looked at people, and he analyzed them and said how foolish people are and how futile life is and that type of thing without God. But he looked at animals, and there are a number of verses in the Bible where he ponders these animals and what they do. And three things are marvelous, and the fourth is too wonderful for me, and all these things, and he's considering snakes and all that. But here he says, Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 6, and when Job, it says in Job, but ask the animals and they'll teach you, what God has created can teach us even about how to live. It says, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. Does he want to know how to live even? Well, God created the universe, and He created animals, and He created everything on earth, and some of that is to reflect what He's like and what He expects us to do. And He said, even you want to know how to handle your finances and how to live your life and work and all that type of thing. He says, go to the ant, consider his ways. It has no commander, overseer, or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in the summer and gathers its food at harvest. When is the last time you ever saw an ant with a credit card? I never have. No, that doesn't really prove anything. But what it's saying is, even about handling your finances, the ant doesn't pay 27% interest on what it gets. It saves for what it spends. And before it eats, it saves for it. And it goes through this process. And it's just a good life lesson, and working hard and being responsible and all those things. There are a lot of other things you can do, and we could go into any aspect, just like Elihu did in asking Job to consider water and all of its formation and everything God does with thunder and all that type of thing. Look at any life form. Look at the ant. There's such thing as a leaf-binding ant. Again, even ants, there's so many different types of ants and species of ants and so forth. But there's a leaf-binding ant, and he builds nests out of leaves that are sewn together. you know, and ants we're familiar with, they will live in trees. If they're carpenter ants, or they'll live in the ground and they'll have their little mounds and things. But these are leaf binding ants, and they live in leaf clusters. How do they build their homes? Well, they obviously, because they build them out of leaves, they go get a leaf, and they pull the leaf off the tree, and gets another one, it puts it together, and then he takes one of his kids, okay, as a larva, okay, and he'll take that larva, and he'll squeeze it, and a little bit of fluid will come out of that, and he'll use that as a glue gun. So he uses his kids as a glue gun to build his homes. That's kind of nifty, isn't it? Who'd ever thought of that? God's got a good sense of humor, too, doesn't he? Wouldn't it be nice to find your kids that useful? There's an African mistletoe. Just a mistletoe. And it would die if it weren't for one particular animal, and that's the sunbird. And what the mistletoe produces, this flower that's closed up, and the flower will not open. You know how flowers will, some especially our some of our cactus, so all of a sudden they'll be open in the morning and hadn't been there before, and all those things are kind of neat. But this mistletoe flower, the sunbird comes along and it sticks its beak or whatever they call it into this flower, and all of a sudden it opens up. Its anthers poke out, and then it puts out the pollen and covers this bird with its pollen. And so then that bird goes around to the next one and pollinates. And if the sunbird didn't exist, the mistletoe wouldn't exist because it never opened up. And actually, all the mistletoe died, and they don't exist because there wasn't a bird to pollinate it sometime in this evolution process. Well, I think that would show you that God exists. He put everything together in a very interesting form. Oh, bats. You know how bats find their prey, their food? How is it that bats... Go ahead. Okay, bats flying through the air. Yeah, it's kind of this... Yeah, so... Radar. So this bat's flying. It's kind of like our airplanes. You know, they've got the radar and all that type of thing. And so this bat flies along, and this radar, oh, there's a bug. And so it hones in on it from that. Now, it doesn't get all of its prey, or what it would like to. There's one moth. It's the tiger moth. The tiger moth actually doesn't get eaten very often by bats because it has a cloaking device that it sends out. And when the bat starts flying towards it, it does a radar block so the bat can't find it and eat it. That's kind of a nifty thing to have evolved, isn't it? Okay, and before that evolved, I guess they got eaten. Why did they need to evolve it if there were enough of them? But anyway, you know, the U.S. military, you know, loves, they got the stealth bomber. I think it's the most expensive bomber in the world, and it sends out this cloaking device so it can't be detected by radar. Tiger moths got them already. There's a Mexican fly called the Ululidus, something like that. It's a Mexican fly anyway. But what it does is it lays its batch of eggs. Let's say there's a twig coming out of a tree here. And it'll lay its batch of eggs right here in clumps. And when it gets done laying its clump of eggs, it'll go right here and lay another clump. Now, this clump is not eggs. This clump is a clump of a liquid. And when it gets done with laying that clump of liquid, the liquid doesn't harden, it doesn't melt, it just stays there for about 3 or 4 weeks until these little flies start hatching. And the reason that's there is because ants in the tree like to go up and eat larvae. So the ant comes up the tree to get the larva, and it runs into this clump of sticky stuff, and it goes, ew, and then starts, you know, washing itself and crawls back down and doesn't eat the fly larva. Kind of a nifty thing. I mean, you could go on, and you could look at anything that God has created and see His marvelous wonders and what He has done. Bees, and I'll end with this one. Bees make these hives, and they're complex combs, and their combs are hexagonal, and the scientists have studied that and figured that that's actually the most efficient way of storage. They're up to 75,000 bees in a hive. And this, when they create, I don't know if all bees do this, but at least some, when they create their hive, they'll start from three different sides and work together to make this hive. You know, if you're in construction and you decide, okay, well, I'm going to send a crew over there, and you start over there, and we'll start over here, and we'll start here, and we'll just get this house. No, you got to plan it. But this, they start from three different directions, come together in this perfect hive. Oh, now bees pollinate, right? That's what's their big draw, in addition to making honey, and you could go into a lot of different things about that. But they pollinate, and there's a group of flowers. Now what happens? One bee goes out, and a lot of bees going out, but to say this one particular bee, name of Betty. And so Betty is flying out, and it finds this batch of flowers over here on an orange tree. And about a half a mile is apparently the range from this hive. So Betty's out here and says, ah, there's a lot of work to be done here. So she assesses the amount of work to be done and then makes her way back to the hive and goes in and says, ladies, come here. I've got a job for you. There's a whole bunch of pollen over here on this tree. Now, how does Betty tell everybody how this pollen is there? Another, yes, sir.
Does a dance.
Now, I think it would have been a lot easier to evolve in just saying, okay, ladies, follow me. You know, I want 15 of you, follow me. And so what it does is that the bee comes back and it starts this dance. And this dance is telling the number of bees that need to go because the amount of trees that need to be pollinated or flowers that need to be pollinated. And it says where it is, which direction to go. So, doing this dance, you know, and she's going around and doing a little, you know, zigzag and this dance and showing them. And as a result of this dance, what she's doing is lining up. The sun is here, flowers over there, amount of flowers, hive is here, and they line up with a line in the sun with a dance and where the flowers are, and it tells them where to go. And these other bees are watching, and they got these eyes with these microscopic hexagonal things in it, you know, and looking around and watching and observing Betty doing her dance, right? And she ends up doing this figure eight. She walks around and says, how do you like that? I'm going to be on TV so I can dance. Now, that's kind of nifty in itself, but the problem is you're lining this up with the sun. And what happens with the sun? Well, the sun doesn't stand still unless that's a miracle from God where it causes it to stand still. But the sun, it will move its position 1 degree in longitude for every 4 minutes. So from the time Betty was there flying back from the tree to the hive, time she gets done with the dance, things have changed. And so all these bees fly out and they say, what? Ask a woman for directions, you know? Sorry, no. But no, actually, it's built in to where there's this, and the dance compensates for the motion of the sun from the time she left, the time the dance is done, and they go, and then where they go from there, and how long it takes, and the sun moves from there. And it's evolved. You know? And they're talking about these chances of one little protozoa evolving, but then what about all these things going in, you know, into this marvelous creation. Not going to happen. Albert Einstein, he says this, the scientist is possessed with universal causation, basically creation. I mean, any scientist that really looks, and you look around, or just a normal person who looks around, say his religious feeling takes the form of a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic thinking and action of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. You know, compared to what God has done and the creation He's made, our thoughts are so insignificant. You know, God is so great, and God is involved with you. And God listens to your prayers. He listens and sees your needs. And He does care, and He can do whatever He wants. I want to close with a poem that somebody wrote. It's entitled, God Speak to Me. The man whispered, God, speak to me. And a meadowlark sang, but the man didn't hear. Then a man yelled at God, speak to me. Thunder rolled across the sky, but the man didn't listen. And the man looked around and said, God, let me see you. And the stars shined brightly, but the man didn't notice. And the man shouted, God, show me a miracle. And a life was born. The man didn't know it. And so the man cried out in despair, touch me, God, let me know that you're there. Whereupon God reached down and touched his arm. And the man brushed the butterfly away and walked on. Now God is there, and God speaks to us through his creation. He speaks through us to us through his relationship with us, through the calling that he's given to us, when he opens your mind and shows you spiritual things that are undetectable to the mind that's closed. God speaks to us in many ways. His creation cries out for us to pay attention to him, to involve God in our lives, and to see what he's doing on earth. And as the Creator, he gives us laws, he gives us rules, he gives us punishments, he gives us rewards, and he expects us to listen. He expects us to pay attention. He expects us to act and to react to him. Look around you. Learn from what he's teaching us. Are we listening?